I knew I was going to feel somewhat sheepish, but the time had come to really open my mind, hopefully not so wide as to allow my brain to fall out and attempt something that was well outside the realm of my beliefs and experience. I would have been mortified at the time if any of my mainstream friends had known what I was about to embark upon. Anyway, there wasn't time to do any reading on the subject. I would just have to experiment. I made myself comfortable on the bed, propped a couple of pillows under my head, closed my eyes and concentrated on relaxing. I conjured up a mental image of the individual I wanted to contact, a female whom I had befriended a year earlier. It was now August of 1998, I had good reason to believe that she had the required abilities, if anyone did. Gina, it's Phil. Please contact me. Gina, it's Phil. Please contact me. I tried to project my thoughts by simply concentrating on directing them to the mental image of Gina that I held in my mind. I repeated the phrase silently several hundred times over a period of an hour or so. Nothing. Finally, I gave up and busied myself with some chores. I was right. I did feel foolish and silly. However, I put aside some time and attempted it again the next day. This time, I went into the den, closed the shutters, turned out the light, and sat in the dark, staring into the colorful patterns of the iron storm of the Star Trek screensaver image. I let myself become mesmerized by the flowing lights, feeling that I was in a nearly trance-like state. Again I thought of Gina, and I silently repeated the same mantra. The colorful, swirling patterns on the screen drew me in, and I became lost in time. I was not aware of my surroundings, only the hypnotic, psychedelic powers of the screen that seemed to envelop me. After what seemed like 10 or 15 minutes, I glanced up at the clock on the wall and was amazed to realize that 2 hours had passed. All that time, I had continuously kept up the silent mantra. Again, there was no response, not that I really expected any. This was just a playful exercise in what I considered metaphysical amusement, but I was alone in the house, I had time to kill, and I didn't see any harm in it. I actually approached it like a game, more entertainment than serious research. All the while, the logical part of my brain would surface periodically and sneer at me, asking me just what in blazes I was trying to prove. I ignored it. Okay, I was satisfied. Mental telepathy either doesn't work or I lacked the powers or the knowledge to access it. I gave up, at least for the time being. But things can look different in the light of a new day, especially after a good night's sleep, and the idea continued to intrigue me. So, having nothing better to keep my mind occupied the next day as I cleaned the kitchen, vacuumed the carpets, made the bed, and ran over to the post office to check the P.O. box, I played with 100 mental variations on the theme during the day. I concentrated with furrowed brow, I mentally relaxed and tried to project gentle thoughts while thinking of Gina. I spoke the words out loud at times, I tried to visualize my thoughts as a physical beam that I projected outward. And so it went for most of the day. No response, as far as I was aware. And then an interesting thing happened. Tired of being cooped up in the house, I grabbed a book and headed for the local mall, where I bought a diet soft drink and sat myself down at a table in the food court. The place was crowded with the usual teenagers just hanging out and probably trying to fill their boring summer day with some distraction, which typically takes the form of fertility right socializing. I half-heatedly read a few paragraphs of the book I had grabbed, but my mind was wandering and I began thinking about my efforts to contact Gina. The din of the place receded into the background, and soon my brain had blocked out all distractions. I found myself totally focused on her. I was doing it again, almost subconsciously. I spent minutes staring at the book and absent-mindedly sipping my drink, becoming almost oblivious to my surroundings as my mind became totally preoccupied with trying yet again to send a telepathic message. Finally, I became aware that an Asian teenage girl, very slightly built, who was sitting with 3 other girls at a table to my right, was speaking to me. She had said "excuse me" several times before I came out of my fog, and it dawned on me that she was speaking to me. "I'm sorry," I said, shaking my head to clear it. I was lost in my book. It was a little white lie, But it was an easier explanation than trying to tell her that I was trying to commune with someone who wasn't there. "Did you say something to me?" she asked. She had penetrating brown eyes, which sparkled with curiosity, and she gave me an inquisitive smile. "What? No, I... Wait, weren't you speaking to me?" I asked awkwardly, feeling as though I had just stumbled and fallen on my behind in front of the whole food court. She obviously sensed my uneasiness. As pubescent girls are hormonal inclined to do at almost any time, she began giggling and was quickly joined by her friends. "I thought you had spoken to me," I said. "No, before that," she said. "Did you say something to me before I spoke to you?" Her friends began giggling even more. We weren't getting anywhere, so I excused myself and went back to my book and took another sip of my drink. This time I actually read a page or two. 3 or 4 minutes passed and I considered strolling through the mall before heading back to the house. But before I could rise from my chair, the teenage girl got up and began walking toward the hamburger joint. "Ginny, bring me some ketchup," one of her friends called after her, waving a single French fry. Ginny, or perhaps it was Jeannie or Jenny or something very similar, waved awareness of the request in return. I was riveted to my chair. I smiled in delight and amazement. "No way," I thought. "This is just a coincidence." But was it really coincidence? Was it possible that the young girl whose almond eyes and slight body build were not all that dissimilar to Gina's had an ability, perhaps unrealized, to receive telepathic messages? And then there were the similar names, Gina and Ginny, or what sounded like Ginny. For one foolish moment, I considered trying to strike up a conversation with the girl so that I might stay in touch with her to possibly try some telepathic experiments later. Suppose she really was a receiver for such messages? What a terrible, wasted opportunity if I let her just disappear from my life. Maybe she even had the ability again, most likely unrealized, to also transmit extrasensory messages that others might be able to receive. The young lady returned to her table and resumed the girlish, giggling interplay with her companions. On two occasions, I turned with the intention of talking to her, but backed down both times. I had to be realistic. I would have had to ask her name, and at least a phone number, if not her home address, if I were to befriend her and persuade her to take part in the test that I had in mind. But common sense prevailed and I resisted the temptation. I thought of what my reaction as a parent would be if some old man approached my daughter in such a fashion. I took a final sip of my soda, got up and went home. Observation by Paul. Try something. There is no glory in surrendering before you even know what challenge you face. One, a bit of clarification is required here, particularly for those who have read my last book. I had discussed telepathy previously, had suspected on at least one occasion that I had received telepathic signals, and had been told by Paul during our initial meeting on that Easter Sunday in 1999 that I had been summoned via that medium. But at no time did I ever believe with a fair degree of certainty that I was a telepath of even the lowest order, or that I had ever engaged in a two-way telepathic conversation. Our paths cross. Months passed without significant incident after the encounter at the mall. Then on April 2, 1999, Good Friday, I was lying in bed about 6:30 a.m., fully awake but not yet ready to get up. I wasn't thinking of anything in particular as I luxuriated in the comfort of the warm bed, when I was suddenly overcome by a strange sensation that I found delightful and borderline sensuous. Next came a sense of mental clarity washing over me, sweeping away any lingering cobwebs of sleep. I knew I was lying in bed in my physical body, yet I felt that I somehow existed concurrently on another plane, in a remarkable dimension. It was a place that I knew, with all of my being, I had never visited before, and yet strangely enough a region in which I felt completely at home, as though I truly belonged there. The feeling was not unlike that of déjà vu, although much more intense. My mind was crystal clear, and in that clarity I understood that I was at the moment residing in a part of the brain that I had never before consciously explored. How I had gotten there was a complete mystery. Some people contend that we humans use only 10 to 15% of our brain capacity, the remainder lying fallow throughout our lifetimes. Then there are others who claim that is strictly a myth. Perhaps the truth lies somewhere in between. We all have the potential, which may someday be realized, to perform the various feats that certain adepts do with such facility. Somehow, I felt that I had crossed over into such an ethereal reach and or had been pulled over by some unknown force. Whatever it was, I was there and I was enraptured. And then it happened. I didn't hear the words spoken. I don't believe that I even cognitively thought them independently. The thought was just suddenly there in my mind. Seek out the angel and you will be sought in return. Then the door seemed to close and I returned to Earth, metaphorically speaking, back to that rather uninteresting, tedious part of the brain that carries most of us through our lives. The experience had occurred abruptly and was over quickly. But even so, I was convinced that I had momentarily been in some personally uncharted waters. I knew instinctively, perhaps even intellectually, certainly emotionally, that this experience was profound. This was not just a random, meaningless thought that had popped into my head for no apparent reason. I was mystified by its meaning, by its significance, if any, and by its origin. Seek out the angel and you will be sought in return. What in the world could that mean? I thought, as I lay in bed for another hour pondering the experience. I even consciously sought to return to that wondrous dimension of lucidity, certain that I could find the answer there. But I was locked out, still residing in that side of the brain that yields no easy answers. I was banging on the portal to the other portion, to no avail. Seek out the angel. Los Angeles is known as the City of Angels. Could that have something to do with it? Was I supposed to go to Los Angeles? That didn't seem to make much sense. I practically live in Los Angeles just outside the city limits, but within Los Angeles County. Maybe I wasn't supposed to go anywhere but, rather, look inward. Introspection is a form of seeking and can be done without moving a muscle. Then again, I had to give some consideration to the possibility that perhaps this was just my imagination working overtime. Once again, I immediately rejected that notion. The experience had been too intense. I was firmly convinced that something strange was going on, but its obscurity was maddening. About mid-afternoon, after my wife had left for work, I began straightening out the bookcase in the den when I came across my appointment calendar for 1998, or perhaps I was drawn to it. I don't even know why I had held onto it. As I curiously flipped through the pages, the entry for Sunday, April 26, 1998, caught my eye. A light went on in my head and suddenly I understood. On that weekend in 1998, my wife and I had driven to San Francisco to attend a presentation by a noted author on angels, Doreen Virtue, with whom I had exchanged email messages. I had never met her personally, but something about her, her books, and her messages intrigued me enough that I was willing to make the 700-mile round-trip drive to attend her lecture. At one point during her presentation, she asked the audience if anyone could see the guardian angel that she said accompanied her at all times. A smattering of people raised their hands. I was not one of them. However, some hours later, in the middle of the vast emptiness of the San Joaquin Valley in central California, as we hurtled homeward down the slice of asphalt and concrete known as Interstate 5, I casually turned to my wife and asked, "Did you see it?" "What?" she asked, turning to look out of the side window. "No, not out there." "The angel," I said. "Did you see the angel that the writer was talking about?" "I'm afraid not," my wife responded. "Me, neither," I said, and we drove in silence for most of the remainder of the trip back home. But I had seen it. It was standing behind her, towering at least a foot over her, perhaps 6 feet 6 inches to 7 feet tall, an ethereal form in human shape that was paradoxically visible and yet transparent in apparition. When I first became aware of her angel, I stared transfixed and my breathing became shallow. No gasps of surprise came from the audience, which puzzled me and caused me to consider several possibilities. Others were more receptive to the sighting of an apparition and thus would not express overt wonder, or perhaps I was hallucinating, had gone into some sort of hypnotic trance, and only I was seeing it. I had looked at my wife for some sign of confirmation, but saw none. I really didn't want this to be happening, it was too uncanny for me. It seemed as though I had been lurching drunkenly through life for the previous year, and just when it seemed that I was getting my bearings again, some other extraordinary event would come along and flummox me. Well, I was going to sit on this little incident. It would remain my secret, at least until I got some answers, until I understood whether these things were bona fide or if perhaps I was starting to lose my marbles. I stared at the figure behind the author, making an effort to study the eyes, the nose, the mouth, the shape of the face. But the more I stared, the more I realized that I couldn't really focus on any part of the figure. I was getting an impression rather than a sharp picture. I soon discovered that if I looked slightly off-center of the specter, using my peripheral vision, I actually got a much clearer view of it. After her lecture, the author made her way downstairs to a table where she autographed copies of her books. The apparition stayed right with her. I was drenched in sweat by the time my wife and I got out of the building, and I knew that my sticky shirt and wet forehead were due to more than just the heat of the day. I was emotionally rent. "Seek out the angel and you will be sought in return," I would be told later, that when the thought flashed through my mind on that Good Friday as I lay in bed, I had received a low-level telepathic message, a simple summons in the form of a compelling hunch that led me to the San Francisco Bay Area, where Paul approached me in a park and struck up a conversation. As I have recounted elsewhere, we spoke for several hours. If I had to take a wild guess about his vocation, I would have speculated that he was either a man of the cloth or perhaps a religious scholar. However, he never gave me any indication that he was my guardian angel. That stunning bit of news would be revealed to me only after my second meeting with him, 9 months later. As he bid me adieu at the end of the day and began walking out of the park, I took off my glasses and rubbed a palm across my closed eyes, massaging my temples as well. I don't see much without my specs. The world turns into a fuzzy, unfocused kaleidoscope of shapes, forms and smears of colors. I don't even have depth perception, and have never experienced that phenomenon because I have a medical condition known as strabismus, in which both eyes don't work together to form a stereoscopic image. I have had this condition for a lifetime. But suddenly, as I watched Paul walk away, the scene in front of me morphed into sharp focus. I was experiencing depth perception for the first time, in all of its breathtaking glory. The image was nothing short of miraculous. Looking out upon this simple earthly landscape, seeing the image as three-dimensional, in which objects projected themselves into space so that I could judge size, thickness, form, and distance, was mesmerizing. My world normally passes before me as a flat field, much the way one sees life on a movie screen, so to see the images jump out of that screen was more breathtaking than I could ever have imagined. And then, just as suddenly, my vision returned to normal, blurry, flat, unfocused, and I replaced my specs. Mysteriously, Paul had disappeared from sight between the time my vision blurred again and then refocused with the aid of the lenses. I should have been able to see him because he still had some way to go before the path took him out of view. I was befuddled and enthralled, simultaneously. The 3D image was a delight to behold, even if I had imagined it, and I was grateful for the experience. But was it authentic or just another tick from my mind's eye? Hypnotism. A neat trick if it could be pulled off, which I doubted, particularly from a distance. And I'm certain that I can't be hypnotized short of being slipped a Mickey Finn or a dose of peyote. I knew what I was doing, looking for a logical explanation for the seemingly inexplicable. If I found it, it would put my mind at ease, reaffirming my belief system. At the same time, a hidden part of me was mentally giving myself a swift kick in the pants for denying what would appear to be the obvious. This was nothing short of a miracle. It was Easter Sunday and I, a long-time atheist, had literally seen the light. I can't say that I got religion. It was more like an awakening of some sort, an awareness of elements that are not normally part of my life. I wasn't resurrected, but I was convinced that I had been profoundly touched by something. If you want to witness a miracle, you three highlighters have already done so. Just thinking the thought is a miracle, as is every moment that you exist. A paradox of terms. Let us flip forward again to 2001, to another miraculous encounter with Paul. Here we were, an atheist and a guardian angel sitting around a flaming fire pit at night in my gazebo. I had already come to terms with the fact that I could see angelic apparitions, if that was indeed what they were. I was also reconciled to the fact that there was an entity of some sort watching over me, and that his name was Paul. He clearly was a physical presence, which I would later learn is a rare occurrence under ordinary circumstances, when they appear at all. For those few privileged individuals who have actually met their guardian angels, it is usually in an ethereal mode, as an apparition, as I had first observed in San Francisco in 1998. I accepted his reality, and yet I still referred to myself as an atheist, a seeming paradox if ever there was one. It was obvious to me that a drastic questioning of my belief system was in order, but whenever the thought rose, I always seemed to find a reason to defer acting on that compelling issue. Even now, I still am not psychologically and emotionally prepared to deal with the problem, so I will continue, for the time being, to avoid what is bound to become a wrenching ordeal. So, I do have the ability to receive telepathic messages, then? I asked Paul. Rudimentary ones on occasion, yes, he replied. But, as I said, you have a long way to go before you will be able to achieve the level of proficiency needed to communicate fluently with other telepaths over great distances. I was actually getting excited. Telepathy. Imagine that. The idea was nothing short of magical, especially for someone like myself, who had never considered such things possible. The idea that I might someday possess that power was intoxicating. Are you going to teach me? I asked. You'll be given the opportunity to develop the innate abilities that most people possess but that few ever discover and utilize. Is that answer a yes or a no? I asked with just a bit of exasperation. Paul gave me a sidelong look of amused sufferance. A little testy, are we? He asked with a sardonic smile. Sorry, I replied. I still had work to do on developing certain social skills, such as showing patience. Paul really is a sweet and charming guy, in fact, angelic. I knew that I shouldn't be blaming him for my own shortcomings, specifically, my inability to not sweat the small stuff, or to accept people as they are without being critical. To answer your question, I'll undoubtedly have a hand in it. But others will also be involved. The one who will be most responsible, though, is you. You will be required to do the work. No one else can do that for you, Paul said. I stared at the dancing flames and noticed that the lava rocks in the fire pit were beginning to glow. I always enjoyed that. Paul and I sat peacefully and silently for several minutes. I was lost in thought while he peered out into the darkness. Hundreds of individual lights sparkled across the valley that lay before us, and the effect can be hypnotic. Finally, I shook myself from my reverie and asked Paul the purpose of his visit, why he had summoned me. I was glad to see him, of course, I assured him. But I was also curious about why he had chosen this time and this place to contact me again. After all, I hadn't seen him in nearly 2 years and, in fact, had not even been certain that I ever would meet up with him again. You called me, he said simply, and I came. I studied his face in the light of the dancing flames, looking for some indication that he was pulling my leg, but he appeared deadly serious. I chuckled self-consciously, quite convinced that he had misspoken, so I pressed for clarification even as I tried to correct his misperception. I called him? He had to be kidding. I was inside my house reading when I felt an inclination to follow a hunch. And Paul had already admitted that he had transmitted the message toward me. I failed to see how that could be interpreted as a call from me to him. I was anxious to hear his explanation. How did you get here? I asked as I walked across the lawn, opened the sliding glass door to the kitchen, and reached for my pack of cigarettes on the counter just inside. Why do you ask? He replied as I returned to the gazebo and lit up a smoke. I was just thinking that maybe you rode in on a time warp, or whatever it is that gets you around, and that you're still stuck in it, I said playfully. What are you talking about? Wait, let me guess, you've taken up a foreign language. I'm sorry to burst your balloon, but speaking nonsense doesn't qualify. Good old Paul. He can give as well as he gets. I laughed. Seriously, though, I understand what you are saying. But let me assure you that I am here because you called me. I started to form a rebuttal, but he continued without pause, talking over my aborted response. Maybe called is the wrong word, he said. Actually, you have been radiating vibes for help for several weeks now, and it was that inner plea to which I responded. I settled back into the seat in the gazebo, blew a plume of tobacco smoke into the darkness of the night, and resigned myself to giving my full attention to his explanation. He said that I had been sliding headlong into a deeper and deeper funk with each passing day since September 11th, although I had been refusing to acknowledge it. Millions of Americans, of course, had been involved in a terrible psychological struggle after that tragic day, and I considered that my feelings were pretty typical of what the average citizen was going through. Surveys had shown a quantum leap in the number of people who were suffering bouts of sleep difficulties. The sales of tranquilizers, antidepressants, sleeping pills, and alcohol had all risen dramatically. It was the natural and easily predictable result of the stress that Americans were experiencing as a direct consequence of a devastating event. And, as I related in my last book, I and thousands of others were also dealing with a related event of almost unimaginable proportions. Although it did not involve the tragic loss of life and crushing economic havoc that were inflicted by the terrorist attacks, the incident was nevertheless a bitter disappointment that compounded and intensified the feelings of loss that we shared with other Americans. "Two, you are in trouble," Paul said. "You may not think so, but you are. You are disheartened and three hiatus, morose to the point where it is beginning to suppress your immune system. Depression can do that, you know. Were you aware of that?" I flicked the cigarette butt into the flames and immediately lit up another. I nodded and replied that I had heard or read about that little bit of medical, psychological theory, or factoid, I suppose, if it is accurate. Worry, stress, anxiety, these can all suppress the immune system. And a suppressed immune system leaves a person vulnerable to attack from all kinds of diseases. "I think that's pretty common knowledge," Paul continued. I told him that I appreciated his concern for me but that it wasn't necessary, and assured him that I was fine. I will admit, though, that I had been feeling somewhat melancholy for weeks, and I seemed to be tired more than usual. I was spending a lot of time in bed, suffering headaches, feeling listless. I had lost interest in many of the everyday activities that kept me busy, and some of which actually used to bring me pleasure. These included the weekly mowing of the lawn, my daily walk, jog, doing the grocery shopping, puttering in the garage, and a host of other chores and pastimes. While not all of them typically brought me the same satisfaction as my newspaper and my books, I still had tackled them without hesitation before the funk had set in. But I figured that my sluggishness was just a symptom of the perilous and challenging times that we were living in. "And that's what I meant when I said that you sent for me," Paul said. "Not consciously, of course. But you were sending out fairly obvious grief signals indicating that you were walking a thin line and needed help. You wouldn't admit it, naturally, you cling to this anachronistic and mythical notion that it's unmanly to show feelings that you erroneously interpret as signs of weakness. And so you keep it bottled up inside, as millions of other men do, until it makes you sick or until it becomes too painful to bear, and then you do something foolishly stupid and irreversible." I leaned forward, rested my forearms on my thighs and stared into the fire. I took a deep drag on my cigarette and blew the smoke out in a stream that glistened white in the light of the flames and then disappeared in a swirl into the darkness. "Maybe I was broadcasting distress signals, but to no one in particular," I mumbled, acknowledging for the first time, not only to Paul but to myself as well, that there had been times in the past month when I felt so heartsick that I really had to struggle with the daily demands of life. The message was getting louder by the day, and I finally decided that I had to answer it, to intervene. "You're feeling lost and you don't know where to turn." Several long moments of silence ensued. "Look at me. Paul said so abruptly that I flinched as his voice cut through the cool night air. My head snapped up and our eyes locked. What were you thinking right before I arrived? He asked gently. It seemed at the time to be a rather strange question.